You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Ouch! So as I was saying, welcome to another episode of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the book to meet the authors and professionals in the publishing industry. And we apologize for that technical difficulty. If you were listening live, we are so very sorry. We will fix that in the edited version. Anyways, back on point. Jason, how we doing?
I'm doing great today, Katie. I'm deaf in one ear now from the squealing, but no, I'm doing good today. It's kind of a gorgeous day in Michigan. It's like 76 degrees and, you know, big puffy clouds floating through the sky. It's pretty awesome. So I can't complain. How's the weather out there in Vegas?
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. But broiling, as we expect it to be. We've got another guest to introduce our audience to tonight, Wes Rand. He is brand new to the scene, and he's got some books he'd like to tell us about, don't you?
Sure, I do. Got three books out, and the fourth is about halfway finished and will be out in the fall. So, yeah. The first book is, can we go ahead and just show it?
Oh, yeah, please do.
Go right ahead.
I don't know if you can see it. Let's see. Up here. First book is Left to Die. I'll explain a little bit about them as we go along here. Try to get some of the shadow off of it, the glare, I mean. Left to Die, second book, Cross Cut. You can see that. Okay, and the third book, Payback is Hell. Okay, get the glare off of that.
Yeah, those look like they were hand-drawn. What kind of an artist did you get to do the artwork for those?
Well, I actually had an artist that's located in the Ukraine. And I found him. He did some nice artwork. We're probably going to redo some of the covers later on. But for the time being, I'm going to go with these covers. And
I like them. They look like they're kind of creepy, intense Western action. Is that kind of what they are, or what are they about?
Yeah, these are violent Westerns. I had been reading some of the Westerns, the Riders of the Purple Sage type, where the cowboy in a white hat captures the bad guy and takes him back to stand trial. Well, I had enough of that. So I decided that I'd create a character that was just as mean as the bad guys. In fact, I wanted him to be so bad that the bad guys were afraid of him. And I think they are. They are in the books anyway.
I like it. Now, are you a longtime Western reader? I mean, have you always been a fan of Westerns?
I read a lot, even when I was really small. And I read a lot of books. I started reading some of the Westerns probably it's been about 40 years ago, started reading some of the Western books. Read the Zane Greys and the Louis L'Amours. Came across George Gilman, who wrote the Edge series. He wrote about him. Yeah, he's out of England. He wrote about 60 books, and he stopped writing them for a while. I think he's picked it up again. But when he stopped writing about 10 years ago, I thought I'd take a crack at it, and the Western books. I'd written some plays for kids and so forth, comedies mostly, but I started writing the Westerns about 10 years ago.
Okay. Now, had you had an interest in writing before that, or were you always a reader?
Like I said, I wrote some plays probably far back, about 20 years ago, but these were comedy plays for kids up in the mountains, and we'd put on plays for all the families up there. We'd get a lot of kids involved. We'd have a couple of hundred people in the audience.
Oh, that's fun. Well, that's a big difference from violent Westerns, though.
Well, like I said, I at that time, a lot of the Westerns on television, Gunsmoke and et cetera, they had the good guy was never a mean guy. It was never a bad guy. Neville Stryker, who is my protagonist in these books. It's a series. Had some of the letters on the saddle skirt rubbed off of Neville. So what's left is Evil Striker. And he's a pretty bad dude.
Nice. Now I see you've got some good Western stuff going on there at your house, and including your Stetson there. Are you a cowboy as well?
Well, every once in a while I've gone out. My partners that works with me has some horses, and I go over there and ride those every once in a while. Okay. That's where I got bucked off the last time.
Now, how did you end up getting bucked off? What were you doing?
Well, I was on the horse and was trying to trot around the corral, and he decided that I should get off of his back about a half a second before I decided I should get off of his back. So, if you ever heard the song "The Strawberry Roan," well, that's about how it was with me. I was flipping and turning and landed in the dirt.
Oh Lord!
Nothing broken though, right?
Ribs. I broke ribs.
Oh man!
Ouch!
I don't know if you've ever broken a rib or not, but if you break your ribs, that's a pretty painful injury. And I've broken them before.
I haven't broken a rib before, but I imagine that would not be very comfortable at all.
Now that we've said that.
I used to do, when I was younger, I used to do a lot of karate, Tai Kung Fu, actually. And I got ribs broken in that several times.
Okay. Well, so you're like a real life badass then, huh?
No, I'm too old now.
I like that. That's a great spin on it. You know, don't talk about the injuries as a bad thing. You're a badass. You endured. It's awesome.
So now when you're out riding and getting bucked off horses and other things, do you carry a big old six shooter with you?
No, but I do have a peacemaker.
Okay.
I go out plunking with every once in a while. I have a few guns.
One of my uncles lives out in Arizona, and he's got a house in Phoenix, and then he has a ranch down in, I don't even know where it is, but it's out in the middle of nowhere, somewhere south. And he's got horses out there. We've been out riding with him before, and he always carries a revolver whenever he goes out riding. And he says it's for snakes, and I always thought it was just because he wanted an excuse to be a cowboy. But sure shit, a few years ago, he was out riding, and he was out with my grandfather, and it came across, gosh, what kind of snakes do you guys have out there? It started with an M, Mojave or something.
Mojave
like
Green.
No.
Mojave Green.
Okay, yeah.
Mojave Green rattlesnake.
Yep. And so he ended up shooting it from the horse, and...
Well, he's a pretty good shot then.
Well, yeah, it was a good shot. He's got the rattle as a souvenir, but he ended up, my grandfather went deaf in one ear after it because he was so close to him. So I can't imagine how the scene looked if Uncle Mike was just like, pow, 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 or what. But So
what kind of gun was it?
I don't know. It's a big old revolver of some kind. I imagine something big and loud.
That's not easy to shoot. The revolvers have a horrible kick on them.
Well, if it's a heavy caliber, it's going to have a pretty good size kick, even if it's a revolver or an automatic or semi-automatic for that matter.
And how does that not spook the horse at the same time?
Well, that's what I was wondering. He must have been a pretty good shot and had pretty good control of the horse.
Yeah, well, and you know, and I didn't ask him about that part, so that's actually a good question.
See, these are important things to know when you're writing a Western, too. You got to get those kind of details right. Just like in the fantasy or sci-fi genre, readers who know will catch you on it if you mess up on things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I know a little bit about guns. I was in the service 100 years ago, back in the 60s.
Okay. What branch of the service?
I was in the Army. I was an artillery officer. Forward observer. I didn't go overseas, though. I was an instructor. I guess the Army figured that our troops would be safer in Vietnam if they kept me in the United States.
well, it sounds like that worked out better for you, because I think it was probably a lot safer over here than over there.
Well, I still have my arms and legs and nuts.
Yeah, those are good things to have.
There you go, all important bits together.
So you have some. I'm not on the page right now, so I can't pull it up. But you have these are more than Westerns. You have some other themes kind of woven into these books as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do. When I first started writing Left to Die, I had Stryker get ambushed, and so they took his horse, and he wandered into a town. And so I needed to come up with some sort of conflict in the town. And I had read a lot of conservative books. I read all of Ayn Rand's books. So I decided, Karl Marx was about that time, and Marxism was all the rage in Europe in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I just had him have a town there. It was called Bickford before this gang of thugs came into town and took it over, and they renamed it Egalitaria. And so they decided to have this experiment, and it was a socialist experiment. And there was a woman there that her husband was killed. They owned a ranch and a farm, and the bad guys took it over. She wants Stryker to help her get it back, and he does. So that's the conflict. And then once I introduced that into the book, I liked it. I felt good writing about it. And so I took it into the second book as well, this cross cut. And then into the third book, Payback as Hell, where it's a freedom of speech thing. And Payback as Hell, George Hearst, who was the father of William Randolph Hearst. You ever heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
At the Hearst Castle? Well, George Hearst made his money in a Comstock load in Virginia City, made about $20 million. And he actually won the Examiner newspaper in a poker game in San Francisco.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like in real life this happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he ran it for a while and eventually turned it over to William Randolph. And William Randolph happens to be in the time period that the series is, Evil Stryker, 1885, 1888. William Randolph's about 25 years old. And so what I did in the third book is I pretended that George had trouble collecting on the debt, getting the newspaper turned over to him. So he hears about Stryker through the woman, Morgan Bickford, who's I've carried through the books. And so he hires Stryker to go get the deed turned over. And Stryker does. Morgan warns him that Stryker will get the deed, but the fellow who owns the paper probably won't survive.
So now, how closely are you trying to stick with actual historical events in these, or are you kind of just loosely weaving some things in there?
In the first book, it was all made up. In the second book, Cross Cut, which takes place in the big tree country there in California, the Big Basin, I started weaving in factual history into the books. I thought it'd make them more interesting. And then in the third book, a lot of factual history in that, in San Francisco and what was going on in San Francisco at that time, and in parts of Nevada and Utah. And in the fourth book, which I'm currently writing, that's about the water wars, where Mayor Eaton in Los Angeles and this fellow named Mulholland, which you may have heard of, went up to the Owens Valley up around Bishop, California, and basically swindled the water rights away from those people up there. And they built an aqueduct and shipped the water down to Los Angeles. And today, Los Angeles gets 70% of its water from the Owens Valley up there, which is basically a desert in many parts of it. So I have Stryker. George Hearst has another problem on his hand from a constituent, so he sends Stryker over there to see if he can help things out.
Okay. So Stryker is he's a cowboy, but he's also a bit of a mercenary then too.
What I did is I stumbled onto this scenario where Stryker is kind of like a Mission Impossible thing, where George, who is a George Hearst, went on to become a U.S. senator. So he was a United States senator, the father of William Randolph. So he was a U.S. senator about this time, 1885, 1888. And so I have George come up with problems that can't be dealt with in the public eye. So he needs someone who can go out there and deal with issues that have to be dealt with. And so I will have this kind of thing going on throughout the series.
Okay, I like it. So Stryker was a very early days black operative for for George. I like it.
Well, like the character, he gets stuff done.
Yeah, Stryker is kind of like, I guess he's a metaphor for the army, you know, for the military. You want him to come in, you want him to win the battle, win the war, and then that's after, and it's ugly, right? War is violent. Mm-hmm. And then after Stryker comes in and takes care of things, you want him to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so
that's the dirty work, and you don't want to see it.
Yeah, so no one wants to actually see war. It's not pretty.
No, and people want resolutions, and we want things to be taken care of. But yeah, it's that ugly, dirty stuff that most of us really, really don't want to look at or have to think about it a lot of times.
Yeah, and we don't know what most people don't know what the soldiers, the troops go through in combat, and so we really need to appreciate those guys and women.
On the flip side, though, people do like to watch war movies and read war books, so it becomes kind of a, they like to see it in the fictional sense, and they kind of turn off the reality that, yeah, people go through all of this, but when it's fictionalized, they can view it as entertainment.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting you say that. I mean, because I love a good war movie, and I'm particularly fond of World War II movies. But I also love the documentaries, even though they are a lot more heart wrenching, I think, than the Hollywood productions are. Just because I know when I'm watching a Hollywood production, okay, this is all fiction. I can sit back and enjoy it. Whereas and I'm watching a documentary, it's like, okay, you know, these people really went through this crap, and it hits home a lot more. But I enjoy that. I enjoy facts with my fiction. I really do. I feel like it not only does it make the material a lot more realistic, but I feel like I'm learning something, you know, with, you know, even if it's a completely fictional story, you know, if they're going through Vietnam and doing this or this or this, I feel like, oh, okay, well, I've gained a little bit more than just entertainment here. So I like that. And Whispers in the Shadows, which is coming out in about a month here, actually takes place during World War II, and parts of it happen overseas during the war. And so there are some factual events, too, in that novel, that I've written, and I had a lot of fun with that because it's one of my passions is World War II history. But I try not to make it so thick that people can't enjoy it, because you start dumping too much history on them at once, and they're like, I don't really want to read a textbook. But
yeah, it becomes tedious. Yeah. But even in the documentaries that they show, you still don't see the violence. Mm-hmm. And the horror that that men in combat actually go through. I mean, they still don't show some of the gruesome injuries.
Yeah.
In these books that I write, I have flashbacks. The Stryker was a major in the army. I was a captain. He was a major. I promoted him above me. So in these flashbacks, I write about some of the horrendous injuries that some of the men go through. I mean, where they a face blown off, basically, with the nose, the mouth, and everything, and the person still trying to breathe and they're still alive, things like that, that you wouldn't actually see even in the documentaries. You certainly don't see them in a war movie. But, you know, lead, hot steel doesn't choose, you know, where it's going to go. It, you know, it does some really bad stuff to people, to bodies, to tissue.
Now, were you, you said that you you never went overseas. Did you witness any of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, we saw some films and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I think a lot of guys, when they come back from combat, they don't want to talk about it, you know, because it just brings back stuff that they just don't want to ever see again.
Yeah, I can understand that. I can understand that, but I've never served and I've never been in combat, so I suppose I really can't understand that. But I can understand the idea of not wanting to relive that.
You can sympathize to a point, but the true empathy can't come out unless you've experienced something like that, which I don't think most of us ever come even close to experiencing that kind of trauma.
And thank God we don't. Yeah. And, you know,
that's why we really need to. I go up to the soldiers in uniform in the airports, you know, and I thank them for their service. And you know what they say? No sweat. You say no sweat. But getting back to the books, I enjoy writing the the weapons. No. And then I get to kill the bad guys, you know. I get to kill them in all kinds of...
There's the catharsis right there. Is, yes, you're showing horror, but you're also showing the comeuppance, too.
Because he carries a carbine. He carries, a Winchester 30-30. He carries his peacemaker. Colt Peacemaker, single action.
And right, I'm not a gun person, but is that actually a model name or is that just a nickname for a gun when somebody calls it a peacemaker?
That's the model name. Yeah, that's
okay. I always wonder because I've heard that thrown around before. And, you know, me not being a gun person, I'm like, oh, you know, that's a great nickname for a gun, the peacemaker.
Is that a 45 or?
Well, I make it a 44. .44 caliber, which is a pretty good sized bullet, and the carbine that he carries in Winchester is a .44-40, so he's able to use the same ammunition in both guns, both weapons. And he carries a straight razor in his back pocket, and that's used for shaving most of the time. And Stryker grew up in San Francisco, and he had some Asian uncles. And they taught him some of the martial arts. So he carries a sai, which he learned to fight with, which was the weapon that I learned to fight with when I was taking some of the karate, is the sai. Oh, you don't know what a sai looks like?
I do. It's got the little three prongs, right?
Ninja Turtles. That's immediately what I think of when you say sai.
Yeah, that's what Raphael carried.
So he sharpens them down to where the points are needle sharp.
Ooh,
nice. So
he used those to fight somebody in the Indian Wars, and then several of the bad guys have taken their last breaths watching their blood drain down the tines of the sai.
Now, Wes, you're here in Vegas, right?
Yes.
Okay, so since you're talking weapons, if you don't know, next weekend here in Vegas at the Flamingo Hotel is Combat Con. It is a convention all about the medieval martial arts and sword play.
Wow.
A wonderful convention to go to. I'm actually hosting some of the writer panels there.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Wonderful event to go to because you do get to see it in action.
Wow.
The contest we're running, well, actually, we're not running. The convention's running it, but it was an idea they threw out. It's called the Page to Stage Contest, where writers submit fight scenes.
Oh,
and the winner gets to see it acted out by real stuntmen. It's really cool.
Oh, let's take a look at that. Wait, is that the number?
Weekend, definitely check it out. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Flamingo Hotel on the Strip.
Do you have to have a badge, or can you just pay an entry fee and go in, or what?
it's free to get in to just look around, and they have a lot of displays and they have a vendor floor. If you want to get in on the panels, they do have different fees for different things. So if you want to just go in the writer track, I believe they have a pass you can buy for that, or they have full weekend passes. But just to get in and look around is free. So you can come and see if it's something that interests you. But it was really cool when we went last year.
Was that the first time you went?
Was the first time I went, but apparently they've been doing this for years. I had just recently heard about it.
Yeah. I stopped doing that like when I was 40, which is actually like 30 years ago. And my instructor that I had, who was actually a 10th degree black belt here in town, but he shot himself. And so I thought I'd broken several ribs. And so I decided, okay, you know, there are certain things in life that you go through where you say, okay, I did that, and then I'm going to move on. So
that's kind of, for me, that's a bucket list item. I would love to get in on the HEMA competitions, which I forget what it stands for, but it's essentially medieval swordplay. And there are groups around that actually teach this. And I know there's some in Vegas. I just need to figure out who they are and where they meet, but they teach actual sword play. They teach different styles. They teach with like the rapiers. They teach with the big broad swords, and they have these competitions. And that's one of the big draws for Combat Con, is these are where all of the HEMA people compete for medals. And they have some really cool displays that they do. And I've watched some of the competitions last year and was just amazed by what they can do. And these are real swords they're holding.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't alive back then, because those soldiers just went out on the battlefield and hacked each other to death. That'd be pretty tough.
It's interesting that they have such skill with them too, because you think when you see this big giant broadsword, you know, how heavy it is and how hard it would be to swing without hurting yourself. Yeah. And you've got these big burly guys and they're just throwing the swords around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you have to be pretty strong. Arnold Schwarzenegger type.
It's definitely fun to watch. And they also taught about the different types of weapons too. And, you know, certain weapons were like the rich man's weapon. You know, they're lighter, faster, didn't do as much damage. And then they had the big giant swords. And each one had a different style associated with it.
Yeah, yeah. And a different part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The different styles. Yeah.
Those kind of things are fun to check out. They really are.
Now, Wes, how did you get into publishing? Are you an indie author? Are you self-published, or do you work with a publishing house?
Well, I worked with Lulu for a while, and then I ran into Tim, and so established publishing Wild West Books. And not only are we going to be publishing my books in the future, we'll probably be publishing some other books as well. You know, other Western books. Yeah. A little story about Western literature. You probably haven't been up to Bryce Canyon or Zion or Grand Canyon. Been in any of those places?
Not for a very long time. I've actually yet to go to the Grand Canyon. I've lived out here more than 20 years, and I still haven't been. But yeah, it's not too far away from us here. It's what, 3 hours from Vegas?
Yeah, the South Rim. I've hiked it several times, rim to rim.
I keep saying I'm going to bring the kids to camp there, and every summer that we decide to go, something always prevents us from doing it.
I was just up there weekend before last and took a mule ride down into the canyon from the North Rim on the Kaibab Trail. But the point I was going to make was that if you go up into those national parks, you're going to find a lot of Europeans. There's a little rodeo there in Bryce Canyon by Ruby's Inn. And I don't know, it holds maybe 400 or 500 people in the stands. Oftentimes when I go up there, I'm the only American. All the other people there are Europeans. A lot of Germans, a lot of Scandinavians. And so I was curious about why the Europeans liked Western so much. In fact, I don't know, it's probably been 15 years ago. I read something in the Family Weekly or whatever that insert is in the Sunday paper. They asked Europeans, when they came to the United States, what landmark did they most want to see? And I thought maybe the Empire State Building or Washington Monument or maybe one of the national parks, you know, Great Smoky Mountain Park or something like that. None of those. What they most wanted to see was the American cowboy. Isn't that something?
Why? was.
In Germany, in about the same time period that I'm writing these books, there was this fellow. He was a scoundrel, a thief, a liar. His name was Karl May, and he landed in jail time after time. And while he was in jail, he found out that he liked to write Western books. And he wrote Western books. He never came to the United States. Cowboys and Indians magazine, which I get, says that Karl May sold more Western books than Zane Grey and Louis L'Amour combined. Isn't that something?
Wow.
Karl May. K-A-R-L-M-A-Y. And that's why, that to this day, the Germans really love Westerns.
No kidding. And he'd never been here, huh?
Never came. He came to New York once and then went back. Never went out west. But his main character was this guy named Old Shatterhand, who worked on the railroads out west.
What a great name. Sorry. That's a really good name.
Old Shatterhand. And Albert Einstein read every book that Karl May ever wrote. I thought it was interesting. So did Adolf Hitler, but I like the Einstein. I like the Einstein reader better.
Yeah, I would too.
That sells just a little bit better.
But isn't that something? I mean, here's a guy. What's his IQ? 170. Put out the, you know, the E equal MC square, and, you know, the general theory of relativity, which if you've ever tried to wade through those books, it's tough. But he read Western books. He read all of these Western books.
That's funny. That's funny. No, I went through a period where I was reading a lot of Westerns, but I had gotten introduced to Louis L'Amour, and it was like 20 years ago now, and I burned through in one summer just about everything of his that I could find, and I really enjoyed him. And it's weird because I typically read, I would read Stephen King or Dean Koontz or Michael Crichton, and it was such a departure, but I enjoyed it because it brings you to another place. It brings you to a whole nother world, but it's still our world. You know, it's just, it's kind of a cool departure from the everyday for us, I think.
I'll get your address, Jason, and I'll send you out some real books.
Yeah, that'll be good. That'd be good. I like it. Well, now, do you watch any Western movies? Any of the modern Westerns that they've come out with?
Yeah, you know, well, modern, I guess, is relative. But Sergio Leone, if you haven't seen Once Upon a Time in the West, I consider that to be the best Western movie made.
Okay. And that's still a few years ago now, right?
Yeah, it probably came out like 1968 or 9 or something like that.
Okay.
What, in your opinion, makes for a quality Western? What are some of the key elements you have to make either a book or a movie a quality Western?
Well, first of all, the main character has got to be bigger than life. And which is what a writing instructor told me at UNLV one time. Her name was Faye Fine. She said, make your main character bigger than life, larger than life. So you have to have that. You can't just have an ordinary guy unless you turn him into, you know, someone who's bigger than life, which is Unforgiven. It kind of happened there because he turned into a real badass, you know, at the end of the movie.
I loved Unforgiven. That was, I thought that was great.
Yeah. And, you know, in that movie, at the last scene when he's in the saloon, and he says, "Yeah, I've killed women and children," but yet he was still seen. What was his money? Was his last name? I forget. He was still seen as a good guy in the movie, but he was a bad guy. You never saw him killing women and children.
Yeah,
but you saw him killing unarmed men.
In the whole movie too, you watch it, and he seems like this broken down old kind of old cowhand or old cowboy, and he doesn't look imposing. And of course, you know, he's awesome because he's Clint Eastwood, but yeah. You know, you get to the end and then that scene in the saloon, it's just like, holy shit. I mean, not only is he a bad guy, he's also a badass, and he just cleans house. No, that was fun. But I'm also from a later generation of Western watchers than you. I wasn't around when all the older Westerns were coming out, so I never grew up really appreciating them. And Unforgiven was probably one of the first Westerns that I was really introduced to as a movie, anyway. And of course, now there have been a number of them in the last few years. And gosh, what was that? One of those recent ones? It was with Chris Pratt, and it's like The Hateful Eight or The Magnificent Seven, something like that. But I thought it was pretty enjoyable. You know, a lot of modern special effects, but yeah, you know, I still like a good Western movie.
But yeah. Before we jump off topic too much, because I really want to figure this out, because I don't read Westerns, but they are hugely popular. Mm-hmm. So you said step one, bigger than life character. Does their motivation have anything specific to do with it? Because you just said that characters can do evil, horrible things and still be looked at as the hero. So is it they're doing these horrible things in the name of a good deed or something?
Normally the Western protagonist, the good guy, if you want to call him that, has his own code, and he follows his own code. Okay. In the old days, that code coincided with the what was good in society. Nowadays, he's just on the edge, the edge of what between good and bad.
So it's that vigilante-like mentality.
Right, but because he kills the bad guys, you know, that allows him to have the upper hand. But you want to see, in a Western, you want to see the bad guy get his. And I think throughout the Western books and the Western, just the genre period, the Europeans, they see that character as standing for, you know, something that's good. He may not be the best guy in the world. One of the best Westerns that came out within the past few years was 310 to Yuma. I thought that was a good movie.
Yeah.
So we're kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're kind of looking at somewhat similar to the superhero, only in a different setting. Instead of superpowers, they're just a super shot. And they're holding their own code of justice and doing it in the best possible way that they can with whatever their superpower is.
Did you see the movie 310 to Yuma, the most recent version? Okay, in that movie, and Crow, what's his name?
Russell Crowe and Christian Bale.
Yeah, Christian Bale is the good guy. And he's trying to take a prisoner to stand trial. Russell Crowe is the bad guy. But at the end of the movie, Russell Crowe redeems himself. He turns on the bad guys, his own men, and kills them and gets on the train. Russell Crowe is the prisoner that Christian Bale is trying to take to stand trial. And he sees Christian Bale that he's actually standing for something good. And at the end, Christian Bale gets killed, and then Russell Crowe kills his own men, and then gets on the train for him.
Well, was that whole time, you know, Bale is trying to not only trying to do something good, but I think trying to redeem himself in the eyes of his son.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of a weak guy. He's not strong.
Well, you know, he's bad foot. Yeah,
you know, the movie wasn't what I was expecting at all. It really wasn't, because I didn't see the ending coming at all. But yeah, I thought it was a really well made movie.
And if Russell Crowe had just escaped and ran off with his men, the movie would have been just so-so. But that's not what happened. You know, he turned and he became a good guy.
So is that character arc the big important thing?
I think so.
From maybe just bad guy to good guy with his own code?
Yeah, either a bad guy who redeems himself, you know, by doing something good, or an average guy that you don't know is a real bad guy that reveals himself later on in the story.
Well, have you, either of you read any of Lee Child's books, the Jack Reacher books?
Yes.
Okay. And in my mind, you know, the way we're talking about character development, Jack Reacher is, it's kind of the equivalent of a modern Old West cowboy. You know, when you read his books, he's larger than life. He's a huge guy. He's got tons of skills, both with his hands and with weapons. And he always finds himself in these situations where he's trying to help someone that's kind of been shit on by either the world or by someone. They've been attacked by someone in particular. And he's a good guy, but he doesn't always necessarily do things the way the good guys would do them. He goes and he's going to track down the bad guys and mm-hmm. going to kick the shit out of them and maybe kill them.
Yeah, and he has special skills.
Yeah, and I always
particular set of skills.
yes. I find his character so satisfying because I always get sick of these books and movies where the good guys are just so good that they can't just kill that bad guy even though you know he needs it. Like, no, he needs to die.
Yeah,
kill this sucker.
That's right.
Deadpool is so popular. It's that anti-hero that we love. Want somebody who, yeah, he talks a lot of crap, but he does get the job done. And, you know, we can overlook some of the bad things he did because he's just got such good flair about it.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Stryker doesn't talk very much, and he's an efficient killer. He's not sadistic. He kills quickly and efficiently. But he's not much of a talker.
No, see, definitely. That's the other thing people love is the just quippy one-liners.
Yep. Now, does he enjoy the killing?
No, he just kills. See, what happened is his wife was killed, and he accidentally killed her because he sent a round out of safety sector during a demonstration. Another man, a competitor in a munitions company, sent the wrong coordinates down on the guns, on the howitzer. And Stryker sent that round out, and it killed his wife and her family. He hunted that man down and killed him with a saber through the gut. And he's wanted for murder. So he's been on the run. So he's no longer in the military or anything like that. He's just out there.
Well, and see, and that adds another interesting element to it because he is on the run. There's never going to be a settling down for this character.
No, and he's haunted by the memories of her death because he found her. She was still alive when he found her, but her body was pretty mangled, and her last word was his name. And so then he has these nightmares all the time where he sees her bloodied and mangled on the field from that artillery round that killed her. So it haunts him, and it's really pretty. So he's like a wounded, snarling animal that when confronted bites, but he doesn't bite an arm or a leg. He goes straight for the throat.
I like that. You've given a lot of depth to this character, and I think that will translate well to readers. And it, when characters have a lot of depth and feeling to them, people really latch on. They want to get to know them, and especially since you're writing a series, they'll want to keep looking at what happens next and what happens next and see if, you know, his character will change or grow or hopefully maybe find that redemption at some point.
He probably won't ever have that.
Poor guy. He's just going to be in it forever. Enjoy watching him kill people.
Morgan, who's a woman he's met, told him that sooner or later a bullet will be faster than yours, and that'll be the end of you. And then she suddenly realized that he didn't want to grow old. And that she didn't want to see him grow old either. Businessmen grow old. Men like Stryker don't grow old.
Now that sounds like a great tagline for a book.
Yeah.
It's in Left to Die.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's a good, powerful statement that really makes you want to know about this character who doesn't fear death and who's ready for it.
Yeah, he's a fearsome foe when you come up against a man who's not afraid to die.
Yeah, because you end up with somebody who's truly unpredictable. You don't know what they're going to do, and you can't estimate what your chances are with a person like that when you come up against them.
Yeah. Well, he's pretty good with the gun and the blade, but yeah.
Well, you know, some people will try and talk their way out of a situation. You can't do that when there's nothing you can leverage.
Yeah. Yeah. So, he's going to continue. He's in this time period, 1885, 1888, and he's going to have these series of a task, you know, situations that he gets into.
So now let's go back and talk about your choice to go self-publishing. Did you send this around and try to get agents to pick it up, or did you say, you know what, this is my story, I want it out there?
I did. I sent it out to a few, and then I decided, look, I want to get these books out, and I want to get them published and get them out there. Not only the character whom I really like, Neville Stryker, but I also wanted to get the political message out there. And so that's built into these stories. And so I wanted to get them so that people start reading them. I've given out hundreds of books just to get them out there.
As you do. So yeah. What has the learning curve been like for you when you said, okay, you know what, I'm going to put these out? Did you expect it to be kind of easy? Did you know it was going to be hard going into it? What was your approach initially?
You know, I had no idea. I had no idea.
Sounds like me.
I was surprised to find out that most of the books that I've sold have come from outside the United States.
Wow. In Germany?
Well, England, Germany, France, Japan.
Okay. Yeah. Do they sell pretty well for you?
They're so-so. I'd like to get more. And so I decided a while back that once I got the third book out there, then I was going to start doing the marketing. And so I met up with Tim at Katie's talk. And Tim and I got together, and so we've been working, and things are looking pretty bright.
Good. Tim's
doing a good job for me.
Good. Yeah, he's a man that definitely he definitely knows his way around the system, and he's got a big personality and a big voice. So he'd be a good guy to have in your corner for sure.
Yeah, he's good. He's good. I appreciate him. And get together with Katie here, and we'll expand the effort.
Well, and that's the thing, you know. No matter what you do or who you're working with, we all have more that we need to learn in life, you know, not just as authors or publishers, but, you know, as whatever we happen to be doing out in the world. There's always more to learn, and having friends and colleagues, people that can help you, especially when you're getting started, to learn these things so that you're not making foolish mistakes the hard way, like many of us have. Yeah. And it's invaluable. I mean, if I knew 5 years ago, 10 years ago, what I did now, well, but of course, that's always what we say, you know, the hindsight is 20/20. So you just got to soak up as much of the knowledge as you can while you're there.
Now I have a PhD from the School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah. Well,
it's true though. There's so much to learn. My first book, and I was telling you guys pre-show, I learned the hard way. I did it all myself. I made a lot of mistakes in getting it, you know, not only printed, but getting it edited, figuring out cover art. It was a lot of trial and error on my part. So as I got better and produced more books, I actually started writing down all of these steps so that hopefully other people can benefit from the knowledge that I've had in making those mistakes, you know, that School of Hard Knocks. You know, if you can get the Cliff Notes version on how to do this, go for it.
I've decided to try to get more people involved in helping me, like my wife, Tim, a person like you, Katie, because I don't want to lose the enjoyment of writing the books. You get so wrapped up in marketing the books that you get away from the pleasure of writing the stories, you know? So I want to do that.
Yeah, you are 100% correct there, sir. And being an independent author or even a small press author, we do have a lot more burden on us when it comes to marketing and doing any kind of promotion, aside from just the writing. And the writing is the fun part. The writing is the part that's why we do this, is because we love to write.
Yeah. Tell the stories.
Yeah. Then you get saddled with all the other junk that comes along with it. You're like, whoa, this isn't what I signed up for. I don't want to do this stuff.
Could you imagine Shakespeare trying to make a living today?
Oh,
yeah. Well, I do. I have studied, like, one of my favorite authors was Ernest Hemingway, even though, you know, he was to the left, but I still enjoyed his writing. He wrote like a man. I like that. But I also found some of his early scribbling, and it really wasn't all that good. So it told me that even really great writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald or Ernest Hemingway, in the very beginning, you know, they weren't all that good. And they learned how to write better as they went along. Yeah. So that gave me some advice, you know, that don't beat yourself up too much.
Well, yeah, and when that's one thing a lot of the seasoned authors will tell you is the way you get better is you keep reading and you keep writing, and because you're not going to get good at anything without practice. And we all know that practice is very important. It might not make you perfect, but definitely get you a long ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. Especially the reading part too. Reading within your genre is so important to knowing what's expected of your genre, to understanding what makes these books work.
Yeah. And like Clint Eastwood said, a man has got to know his limitations. So you have to write within your own, you know, within your own ability, you know, your own genre. You know, no one's going to be able to write like F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, his command of the language was breathtaking. Mm-hmm. But you have to write what you can write and enjoy what you write. And as long as you do that, that's okay.
Amen. Yeah,
that's an excellent sentiment for us to end our session on tonight too. Just some nice poignant words there. I love that.
Appreciate you guys having me on.
Absolutely, this has been a great conversation. I think I've learned a lot about Westerns, so I might have to start reading a few myself.
Well, I'll get you some good Western books to read.
Well, I like the whole anti-hero thing, so you've got me hooked there.
Well, there's lots of sex in these things too, so you have to be ready for that as well.
Even better. Yes. And Jason, how about you? Any words for us to part on?
No, I think it's all been said. I think it has.
All right. Well, that's it for us this week on Spilling Ink. We'll be back next week with more authors and professionals to introduce you to. Thank you again, Wes, for hanging out with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's been great talking to you. And thank you so much, everyone, for watching. And we hope you tune in next week.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.